name is Peter Homer. The title of this session is a Bible study on the meal and the road to Emmaus text. Well, good morning, all. We'll be starting by listening. So don't open your Bibles. Sometimes, I for one object to having, it's good to have the gospel printed in the bulletin or something on a Sunday, but it's something to be heard, not to be read so much time. So you get to relax and listen to me read, but I'll be calling upon you to read parts of this. The setting, of course, is Easter Day, and this is the second of three resurrection stories that Luke relates. And I guess I'd like to ask you to close your eyes and use your imagination to try to make the movie of this story here. On that same day, two of Jesus' followers were going to a village named Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they were talking to each other about all the things that had happened. As they talked and discussed, Jesus himself drew near and walked along with them. They saw him, but somehow did not recognize him. Jesus said to them, "What are you talking about to each other as you walk along?" They stood still with sad faces. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only visitor in Jerusalem who doesn't know the things that have been happening there these last few days?" "What things?" he asked. "The things that happened to Jesus of Nazareth," they answered. "This man was a prophet and was considered by God and by all the people to be powerful in everything he said and did. Our chief priests and rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and he was crucified. And we had hoped that he would be the one who is going to set Israel free. Besides all that, this is now the third day since it happened. Some of the women of our group surprised us. They went at dawn to the tomb, but could not find his body. They came back saying they had seen a vision of angels who told them that he is alive. Some of our group went to the tomb and found it exactly as the woman had said, but they did not see him. Then Jesus said to them, 'How foolish you are! How slow you are to believe everything the prophets said! Was it not necessary for the Messiah to suffer these things and then to enter his glory?' And Jesus explained to them what was said about himself in all the scriptures, beginning with the books of Moses and the writings of all the prophets. As they came near the village to which they were going, Jesus acted as if he were going further. But they held him back, saying, 'Stay with us, the day is almost over, and it's getting dark.' So he went in to stay with them. He sat down to eat with them, took the bread, said the blessing. Then he broke the bread and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. But he disappeared from their sight. They said to each other, 'Wasn't it like a fire burning in us when he talked to us on the road and explained the scriptures to us?' They got up at once and went back to Jerusalem, where they found the 11 disciples gathered together with the others and saying, 'The Lord is risen indeed. He has appeared to Simon.' The two then explained to them what had happened on the road and how they recognized the Lord when he broke the bread." Here ends the reading. It's a story that does lend itself to a little play, because there's a lot of interesting action in it. I'm just curious, anybody getting new images of this story as they were rolling it by? Something they might have edited out before?
Oh, I just noticed that the first response when Jesus said, "What are you talking about?" was somewhat rude, like, you know, are you a roofer? You know, how come you don't know what's going on? A little bite to that.
Oh, and it's quite a funny line, isn't it? If you think about it, the irony is immense.
Yeah. Don't
you know what's happening? Are you the only one who doesn't know what happened?
He
knows more than anyone. Well, and what's even funnier, of course, is that they don't understand what happened.
They're in the dark.
Oh, yeah.
They're in the dark about what happened. And that he is the one that knows not only he is what happened, he knows what happened, and he knows what it means. And it's really kind of funny if you think about it.
But it's also an interesting teaching technique that sometimes you need to feign ignorance to learn something from somebody. Sure. And it's not always just deceptive. It's, you know, sometimes people get a little annoyed if you ask questions that you already know the answer. But Jesus did it.
Sure.
Sometimes you do that with children, too. You say, I just can't figure out how to do this. Can you show me? You know, and then that's when they feel like, oh, they're like, oh, yeah, I know how to do this. And that makes them feel good, and you also know what they know. So it's just, Jesus was
changed. Anybody else get an image that kind of jumped out at them?
I guess just right on the heels of that particular thing for me was, you know, he comes along just kind of, I was trying to imagine, you know, you're inviting us to imagine the scene of what it was like, sort of assuming that there were not just those three people on the road, but other people walking on this road. And this stranger just kind of happens to sidle up and walk alongside of them and enter into conversation. You know, I don't know how common that would have been in that kind of culture and that kind of time. And all of a sudden, to switch from that asking questions to, you know, giving. I've often thought, wouldn't it be neat to have heard his words and to hear what it was he was telling them all about the prophets and the history? Was that information that they already knew and he just shed some new light on it or helped them put it together as a whole piece? Or was it information that was something brand new to them? It was, you know, kind of reflective there about what he was sharing.
I think they probably knew the Bible passages that he quoted, but didn't know how it fit. You know, I mean, if you went through the scriptures, I would think they knew that.
Any guesses on what he pulled out?
What
Jesus pulled out?
You mean when he left? What he disappeared from?
No. What scripture he used? What do you think?
Isaiah 53.
Yeah. The suffering servant. Because I think there's a clue to what the suffering and the crucifixion is certainly what's got these guys' head spinning. We had hoped that he was the one. And they're really stuck on they're marking everything in terms of the crucifixion. It's been 3 days since, not a week since Palm Sunday, it's Easter. It's 3 days since Good Friday. Their whole world is fixed on the crucifixion, and Jesus goes right at that. Don't you understand that the Son of Man must suffer?
I think Jesus was really kind of a final review, like, what do you really know? And then I think that he talked with them in more of a casual way, or like he was just one of them, rather than he was trying to be who he was.
I heard it.
Go ahead. Yeah. I was just going to say, I believe that he just sort of led them along and try to find out what they really had put together or whether they had any inkling. And then when he broke that bread, it must have just been like the light bulb went on in all their heads.
What's this they don't recognize in part, though? That's pretty important, isn't it? I mean, RSV says their eyes were kept, doesn't it, from knowing? They were kept from knowing him? Mine says somehow they didn't recognize him. Now, is that intentional?
Well, it seems like it, because then if they had recognized Jesus right away, they would have been like, oh my gosh, what are you doing alive? How did this happen? They would have concentrated on that rather than finding out the whole story of what this had led to and the meaning behind it.
Same thing with Mary Magdalene. She didn't recognize him either.
In John,
Yeah, but you wonder, you know, the last images they had of him, you know, just broken and bloody, and then to see him, you know, vibrant, maybe, and you didn't expect it. Like, occasionally I'll be somewhere without my glasses, people won't recognize me, and vice versa. And, you know, just little things like that will throw people off. So it may have been. Well, it says they were kept from.
Yeah, were kept seems to be intentional. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that's what RSB says. Somehow it says they did not recognize him in the good news, but...
Plus the fact that they knew he had died. And, you know, if any of us were suddenly taken out of this world and 3 days later or so, you saw me again.
What else did they know, though? No, they knew he died. What else did they know?
The report that he had risen that the women said, he's not here, and the angels said...
That's right. They knew that. Okay. I mean, it's important. It's important.
Like Walter said yesterday, women were not credible witnesses in a court of law or anywhere, and they just really disregarded a lot of what
he
said.
Yeah. No. That it, you can see the
so
short.
There's a little sexism in there.
Sure. What were they talking? The discussion. You know what was the discussion? They're having. They're coming down the road and they're discussing.
What did it all mean, or what happened, or why did it go wrong, I guess.
Yeah, why did it go wrong? Yeah. And I think we got a good geography here. You know, they're coming from Jerusalem, which is not just geography, it's the holy city.
The Mecca.
The Mecca. It was Passover. It was the temple. It was the Super Bowl. And their team got creamed. and they're coming home from the game. I try to think myself jammed in the expressway after the Bears got creamed on Halloween night. I sat out there in the rain. And why did I go to that game? There's a undermining quarterbacking. I mean, I try to, that may be a real crass kind of way to look at it, but they're trying to put it back together. I thought we had...
If only,
and isn't this how it was supposed to go? And they're leaving the city, and they're shaking their heads, and they can't leave the experience behind them, and yet it just doesn't add up. And this guy comes and says, well, what are you talking about? Where have you been? Are the only guys that didn't, you know, I mean, the emotions of the, yeah, where have you...
That's how I feel up here when I mention about the rockets, you know, the rockets.
Yeah.
What's that, you know? I mean, that's not quite appropriate, but I thought I'd
bring
Houston rockets in because we're doing so well.
It's even more reinforced by the fact that they're like, and all the people, you know, they're like, all the people thought he was going to be the one to lead us out, but it was those high ruler people, you know, that put him to the cross. So it's kind of like, you should know if you're one of the people of Jerusalem.
Well, yeah, and it's they've got the facts straight. Well, commentators suggested that when they slip right into a creed here, really, that haven't you heard? Well, this is what happened: Jesus, prophet, son of God, handed over and delivered to the chief priests. You know, sentenced, killed, crucified, and just throw Pontius Pilate in there, and you got the creed. This suggested that what we have here is a really accurate summation. It's not the Jews who did it, as you pointed out. It is the chief priests. It's highly accurate, and highly the content of the faith.
They weren't dumb.
Let's go back to chapter 1 of Luke real quick, and see what's going on here.
Incidentally, a theology professor said once the 40 days after the resurrection was the period of postgraduate instruction for the disciples.
Uh-huh.
When you get to be a graduate student.
Okay.
You really understand what happened.
Let's see here. Someone read the... first three verses here. Volunteer.
Many had undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you might know or may know that certainty of the things you have been taught.
Okay, who's Theophilus?
Greeks, the disciple again.
Well, it's a generic name, Theophilus, lover of God.
Yeah.
This, dear Theophilus, lover of God, this is really, you know, John Doe, everyman Christian. This is who he's writing to. Dear lover of God. So this book is addressed to the church, to the people of God. Anybody who loves God, this is the book for you. The deposit of faith has been transmitted to Luke. And what's he going to deliver? A narrative of the things. Things. That word really caught me when I was reading 24. Because we're talking about the things again. And what are the things? And let's go back and look at the things in 24. The things are that happened to Jesus of Nazareth. That's the things. The things that happened to Jesus. Powerful, our chief priests handed him over, sentenced to death, crucified. And then we even get the resurrection report, which is a summation, if you just look back quite quickly, of the first part of chapter 24. It's a very accurate portrayal and summation of the empty tomb. The women go to the tomb. The tomb is empty. These guys have the report straight that the angel said he had risen. That is the thing. That is the deposit of faith. They've got the things straight. What don't they have?
Faith.
They don't have faith. Because in the middle of talking about all the things, verse 21, and we had hoped that he was the one. Guess not.
Another funny thing is you were just talking about the things. Yes. Luke or the beginning and then a chapter or verse 19. What things, Jesus asked. He said, don't you know what's been going on? He said, what things? At least that's the reason.
Yeah, I mean these are the important things. I guess he wasn't the guy. We have the facts, but we don't have the faith. Obviously, they don't believe this report.
Yeah, that struck me. Maybe it's not important, or maybe it is, but they said the women saw a vision.
Yeah.
You know, in contrast to Luke 24, which says two men stood beside them.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't say anything. Well, they had this vision, or they dreamed this dream. I mean, these men were real to them. And yet, in the reporting back and then translating on to these two men on the road to Emmaus, at that point it was sort of a vision. Again, back to your thing about whether it was a credible.
That's right. That's right. Story. So they obviously didn't believe. For all practical purposes, then, Messiah's dead. Therefore, he can't be the Messiah. And if you heard Walt's study yesterday, that I've really enjoyed that in the Middle East, if your country was destroyed, that means your God was no good. And therefore, he was discarded. Obviously, you know, Jesus can't be the Messiah if he's killed. So they are definitely living as if Jesus has died, despite all the good and wonderful things he did, despite having all the facts straight, even up until the report that he is risen. For them, the Messiah is dead, and they're discouraged. Now, I think I mentioned before that when Jesus starts explaining to them, where does he hone in on first? He hones in on the suffering, right? So we're going to have to assume that they were really hung up on the suffering and death, that they just could not compute that into being necessary or leading anywhere. And then we get to the point where it appears that they're at their place, and my book says it appears that Jesus was going farther. And what do they do? And why do they invite him to stay?
Well, something as practical as it was night or near night.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. You know, probably they enjoyed him. They thought he was, you know, someone that they were comfortable with. Maybe they want to talk more that evening over the fire or, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, if they were searching for answers, this guy certainly seemed to have the answers lined up.
Yeah, what clue do we get there? A little later on, in retrospect, they say our hearts burned. Yeah, they were getting answers, or at least fire, for that which had troubled them from before. And is there, I mean, I'm going to argue these are pretty good disciples. And the first evidence to me is that they were discussing. Well, why do I call them good disciples? Why is that a sign?
Well, they hadn't given up. I mean,
okay.
They were still thinking about it.
They were still thinking about it and still discussing it.
No, they must have been disappointed and probably hurt. After all, they were really very close to Jesus. They could have been just warning.
Yeah, they could have been part of the 70, not the 12, but they definitely had hope. These get the impression they were fairly close. But they were still involved. They were emotionally involved. They were sad. They were incredulous. How could anybody not know what had gone on? They had the facts straight.
And they hung around for 3 days to, you know.
All right.
You didn't want to leave the place.
Okay.
Well, they had heard the report, too. That means they had to be somewhat close to have heard of the women.
Sure. They had to have been fairly close to the 12 to have heard that report, too. They, in retrospect, we can see that their hearts burned when the scripture was interpreted, that they were receptive to the word. What about their invitation may indicate they were good disciples?
Watching out for their fellow man.
It's evening. I mean, they're going to show some hospitality. I mean, sure, they're going to gain because they're getting some warmth, if you will, from this guy. But I think the detail about evening also seems to suggest, I mean, where is this person going to go? Now, why does Jesus appear to be going on further? Think about that.
It's a test.
Why?
Well, to see whether they really want to hear more about it.
Why is that important?
Well, it's important to make some kind of a positive invitation, not just, well, he's kind of, you know, what am I going to do tonight? I don't have any place to go. But he really wanted them, he wanted them to respond in like, come in here, we want to talk with you some more.
It's like a measure of their interest.
Mm-hmm.
How interested are they? Do they really want to find out everything, whatever more he has to say, rather than say, well, you know, that's interesting, he's right, bye.
Right. Kind of symbolic of inviting the risen Lord into your life. I mean, they were willing to accept that maybe what he was saying was true, rather than like, well, that's a good argument, but, you know, he's dead, so see you later.
Yeah, and this, you know, what does this say about our discipleship, just the whole process up to here? They're busy in dialogue. Very interesting comment here, by the way, in our first Bible study with a Finnish woman who's leaving soon, who said that her comment on when we read through this was that they were discussing amongst themselves. She said that her language barrier, in that she had to be working in a second language for her in discussing, she realized how important it is to her to have discussions, what a gift that is, and how necessary that is, and how important that is in a place like here, but how valuable and how handicapped, in a way, she felt by not being able to discuss. I thought that was an interesting comment that she made. But the discussion... Is Christ going to show up to people who aren't interested? I guess to cut to the chase. And what responsibility do we have to apprehend the risen Christ? or discipline or whatever you want to call it.
In that sense, you know, he walked beside them, he asked the question, and obviously they must have been open and inviting to him to continue. And, you know, you can imagine that in addition to his teaching them, that there was probably some dialogue and questioning and discussion.
But he chose to remain hidden.
Right.
And back to, well, way back to that, what, does he continue to remain hidden to us, and why? At times. Is that good for us? Is that part of discipleship?
Well, we can't always know his ways. I mean, he has a greater plan. So I guess, and like, looking at it in our everyday lives, you know, we're not always going to see maybe where he's working or how he's working.
There's something about striving for something where you really have to seek for it or struggle with it that brings so much more growth than when you just have the impression that you have it. You know, you may not actually have it. But I think that, you know, if they had felt again that, well, oh yeah, this is Jesus, that's great. You know, sort of like end of story. But, you know, they were doing some struggling. And I think, it just seems like a truism for most of us that if there's something we're seeking, a goal, or struggling with, or working towards, the process itself is, in hindsight, sometimes not at the moment, but certainly in hindsight, seen as a positive experience.
Well, is that not life? I mean, what if the risen Lord pulled up a chair here? Would the game be over?
No.
Well, in a way, as we know it, it would
yeah.
be.
Yeah.
For us Christians of the latter time, it would be over, right?
You mean
if he were good to see you, Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah.
You lead worship tonight. I mean, you take this chair. I mean, we do live in an in-between time yet, as of yet. In, as you suggest, the postgraduate course. I mean, Christ is present by his Spirit, but like you said with the children, you tell me, you figure it out. You were talking about a problem. I can imagine scientists working on a problem and doing experiments and coming up empty. And when someone comes in and says, why don't you try this, and then it works, and then they go, ah, why didn't we think of that? It's so much more satisfying to have thought about 19 other ways. It makes that answer that much more exciting because you've struggled to find the right one. And as you suggested, it is a test. Do they know the things? Is a review? Have they got the facts straight? And it's also a kind of a test to know, well, it's missing. You know, why does Jesus play dumb?
They've got everything in line, but they still don't get it. They still don't get it until.
Yeah. Until. Now let's talk about that. Or Walter Bowman will not let me teach you that. because where we discussed yesterday in his first story was indeed the importance of the meal to our Christian tradition and expression, what makes us distinctive. And what happens, let's take a close look at those words again. What exactly is said there at the meal? Someone want to read that?
Like 29 and 30.
Yeah.
And it came to pass, as he sat at meat with them, he took bread, and blessed it, and brake, and gave it to them, and their eyes were opened, and they knew him, and he vanished out of their sight.
Okay. What kind of language we got here?
It's interesting to me that it's symbolic of the Last Supper. But these disciples, since, well, one of them is Cleopas, and we know he wasn't, you know, at the Last Supper, but we don't know about the other one. It's interesting to, like, was it recognized because he had done this before, or was it just that act?
Well, for us, it's pretty recognizable, isn't it? Lord's Supper language, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it really represents, you know, because like you were saying, they understood everything, but they didn't really get it yet. And it's really a representation of the whole purpose of the whole happening of the resurrection, that he gave up the body for us, and the bread, you know. And it was interesting to me that they mentioned and not the wine, you know, I've given my body for you, but here I'm coming back.
That's an interesting comment.
One of the things that, and there's so much I don't know, but I guess some of the growth that I've had in understanding Passover and, you know, that last meal that Jesus had with his disciples, part of that Jewish tradition of blessing, you know, the cup of blessing and all of that. So obviously, one would think that at least in many faithful Jewish homes, you know, blessings were set at the table. So that in itself wasn't unique. But I've often wondered if there was a way in which Jesus said the blessing, a way in which he presented the gifts of bread and wine to, not just at the Lord's Supper, but, you know, whether that was in feeding the 5,000, whether, you know, it was in any other small and intimate or larger gatherings of his people, that there was something distinctive. It was almost like it was when he did that that sort of lights flashed in their mind. It's like, well, this is the way the Lord does it. You know, this is the way Jesus of Nazareth blessed the bread.
Yes, I agree with you wholeheartedly, but I use the same words. It's both and, isn't it? Not just the way, but their eyes were opened. I mean, we have the words of institution, and that's obviously, to me, well, this sort of reminds me of Jesus. No, it wasn't. It's him.
That's what I'm trying to say. I'm not saying it's just his presence, the way in which he did it.
The way in which.
Yeah.
Every minister has a little different way of blessing the elements and
right.
so on. Uh-huh. I think maybe there's some to that.
Mm-hmm. You know, or every...
Bang, that's him.
Yeah, that sense of the déjà vu that we sometimes
have. Or, you know, their eyes were opened. Now we got the other side of this closed part. They were closed, and now they were opened, which is passive tense. That this is grace. This is gift. This is a decision of God.
Yeah, it just came regardless of how it's blessed.
This is the way. Well, I mean, it's coincidence, if it's coincidence or not, but Jesus has at least chosen that this is the moment of revelation, right? He could have chosen any point to reveal himself, but he chooses at this point in the breaking of the bread. I mean, if you want to use that construction, their eyes were opened at that moment. Is it just a coincidence that it was in the breaking of the bread, or was that intentional? Or was it just, I mean, it's intentional to me that Jesus chose that moment.
Well, he said at the Last Supper, do this in remembrance of me.
Yeah. And this is kind of lesson number one. This is, I will not again drink of the fruit of the vine till I drink it with you in the kingdom. Well, here I am. The kingdom is here.
It's also really interesting, too, about how he disappeared right after that, because I still think that he was trying to avoid, like, by them not recognizing earlier, too, of the whole, our human side of, like, well, how are you alive? You know, like, our human side of, like, wondering about how it happened rather than why.
Or that it did happen.
Right. I mean, I don't know if they would have bombarded him with questions that were, like, because he was really focusing on the why and what led up to this.
Did it really matter to them he disappeared?
Well, they ran back to Jerusalem.
That he disappeared. Did he vanish? That, no problem.
That's
no, I mean, it was enough that they just got up and went. Even though it was night. And what a contrast between these discouraged, sad, long faces. Don't you understand? Oh, it's late. Why don't you stay with us? All of a sudden, whoa, they're off and running. And
they had experienced his presence and then his immediate vanishing before in other situations. So, I mean, that in itself was just been the only thing they needed to see happen, was that someone had the ability to be there and not be there.
And he's risen. I mean, the big problem is he's dead.
Yeah.
And that problem is solved. Now they believe. Now they go running. And coincidentally, Peter's been solved as well, because the Lord has appeared to him, and if we go that far. And then the next story is the final story, is Jesus appears to the 12, shows them his hands and his feet. A different type of appearance, really, but we'll get in. We don't have to get into that right now. But this one is definitely cloaked in the mystery of the Eucharist for us. And I guess the question is for us, I mean, is Christ especially present in the Eucharist in a way in which he is not in preaching and things like that, Bible study? How's it been for you? Is Christ especially present and risen in the Eucharist for you?
You can almost look at it like how they were talking about their hearts burned within them, like a kind of awareness, and then they were made more completely aware when over the Eucharist, you know, or over the breaking of the bread. So it's kind of an analogy. It could be that it becomes more complete when we're at the table.
Well, I think one of the things that I always, just in some kind of comparison situation, I guess, is that there are many Christians that I feel really are very good Christians, but the emphasis is not on the Eucharist at all. I mean, they go to communion once a year or something. But personally for me, it's like a celebration or each time I participate, which is sometimes a couple of times a week at least, you know, is that it really is being present with him, taking him in to me in a very obvious, concrete way.
And the irony is that the big dynamic growing churches, community churches, Willow Creek or Camelback or anyone you want to talk about, really have no central place at all for the sacrament. I mean, it's a little 9 o'clock thing if you want to go like that, and it's ironic that that's really become more and more important only in the liturgical churches. You know, I mean, you can go to these big churches and have wonderful preaching, and what I've been there. Wonderful experience, but the sacraments are not a part of it. It's part of the theology, I think, but it's not.
No, it definitely, according to Luke, this is the key moment. Now, they had the creed, and now all of a sudden they've got faith. Now, if you want to get mysterious about this, anywhere, how does baptism work? We get faith from the Eucharist. Right? Isn't that what this is saying? That's how we get it.
Strengthening of the faith.
Strengthening of the faith. That which we don't have when we come, these guys, they're somehow, and faith is the revelation, the realization that he is risen, no matter, is that right?
I'm just wondering if it's a little stretch to call this the Eucharist. I mean, is this really the Eucharist, or is this they're having an evening meal?
And yet in the early celebration of the Eucharist,
it was,
I understand it was always within the context
of a meal.
Yeah, it says that he blessed the bread and broke it. So.
Yeah.
And even as I think about, you know, the celebratory Passover meal, which of course was something very special for the Jews because of what they were celebrating, you know, the taking the cups of blessing and whatever throughout the meal, it was integrated. You know, it was not something like, well, let's just go and have this cup of blessing.
Yeah.
And it was part of the full meal.
Yeah, probably.
So, just a heightened, you know, awareness of God's presence in there.
I think another interesting thing is, I don't know, what is it, 6 or 7 miles to Emmaus, something like that, from Jerusalem?
7.
I mean, having done a little hiking around here, you know, they had a 7 mile hike and it's dark. They've had supper and they're probably really cooped out.
Well, they spent the whole day getting there.
Really motivated to buzz back and get back in time before the other disciples had gone to bed, although they
probably
were staying up very late. But I mean, you know, they're hitting that place probably 11, 12 o'clock. And that adrenaline must have been pumping all the way back. I think that's a measure of their commitment and their excitement. I mean, they could have easily said, well, hey, let's go down tomorrow and see if these other guys have heard anything. I mean, they were out of there. They just were out of there and went roaring back to Jerusalem. I think that's impressive. I mean,
well,
it's a testimony that their eyes were opened.
I don't think we can ever say this is, you know, the exclusive way in which we gain faith. I mean, faith comes from hearing the word and all kinds of things like that. But in this story, that's the key. They've got the facts, the interest, the discipline, the willingness, they got all kinds of preparation. But in the end, God graces them, or Christ graces them, with a revelation of himself. And the results are prodigious. Implications. You know, what are the implications of this story for us? Forget all.
Better pay attention to the Eucharist a little more closely than we have, or at least that I have.
Yeah, there's a lot more. I think it's interesting if you go a little bit beyond what we've read. And, you know, it starts out where he doesn't show themselves to the two who are walking to Emmaus. Yet they discover him, you know, through the breaking of the bread. And then the next step is when he goes to see the 12 in Jerusalem, and he shows himself, and they know him right away. Yet then the doubt comes. And this may be a minute point, but it's interesting that true, like you say, kind of a leap of faith experience happened in kind of in a symbolic, very important, but yet a symbolic gesture of the breaking of the bread. Yet when he just walked in, like you say, when he walked in and said, "This is me, look at my hands," you know, it says here that even after they looked at his hands, you know, they were still afraid. And then then he opened their minds to understand the scripture and said to them, you know, that he took a more active role, I guess, after the initial, the breaking of the bread portion.
That's what's interesting, is because it seems to me like he's laying the foundation with the two men on the road to Emmaus. He's giving them all their information. Like you say, the faith is still missing, but they have the groundwork. They have their facts, and they have the whole history behind it, and the relationships, you know, and then the faith comes. It's kind of interesting, a way we can kind of look at it, that maybe, you know, faith isn't sprung up overnight. It's, you know, something that has a foundation of the word and other things.
No, we can be doing groundwork, spade work. And then there's comfort in that, the journey. I'm one of these guys who likes to be there yesterday, you know. And it's one of the nice things about coming here. It takes a while to get here. It's an exercise in patience. And but what about the, you know, and there may be, I think it's important. I mean, one of the things I'm going to take from this is certainly, I agree with you, that a little more attention to the importance of the Eucharist in our liturgical life. And but on this, Christ may be walking right with me and asking all kinds of questions, but making me struggle a little bit to get it clear.
And that's okay.
And along with your question of, you know, impact for us, I think, or your question about what does the Lord's Supper mean to us, I think, for me personally, there are times when it doesn't have much impact, and it's not because God's grace isn't there, it's because I'm not in a receiving mood. And I may not be able to acknowledge or recognize that at the moment, but I think it's when I have been struggling or walking or studying or processing, praying, that's when it's most powerful.
Or guilty. Or whatever. What good's a meal if you're not hungry? Right? What good's a revelation if you're not interested in it? And that's part of the mystery to me.
I think also it's an example of the variety of ways in which Jesus teaches. It wasn't a long process, but it was certainly a few hours through the Emmaus, which was sort of almost like discovery learning, Socratic questions and answers and so on. And then to the 12, he just shows up, here I am. And that, you know, they still don't quite get it. He knocks Paul down to the ground, you know, I mean, wham. And then I think probably more often it's like you said, where insight just comes little by little, and every once in a while there's kind of a flash of, you know, have I ever seen that passage before, or a situation in life. But all life is a school, and the Holy Spirit's teaching us, and it's for us to keep our antenna. I mean, so many things when you look back, you say, you know, man, it's so plain. And that's, I think, must happen to the disciples. They look back when he told them, I've got to go to Jerusalem, I've got to die. And their response was just like ours would be if somebody says, hey, I'm going to die. You know, grandma or mom or anybody says, I think I'm going to die. No, you're not going to die. Don't talk that way. You're okay. Maybe they want to talk about it. Okay? And Jesus wanted to talk about it. He said, no, far be it from you, Lord. No, it's not going to happen. They look back and say, gee, we didn't mean it. We didn't understand it. And it all comes together. And sometimes through the preaching of the word, or sometimes through an experience, or Eucharist, or what, you have those sort of highlights and think, wow.
Well, there's looking backward record, there's validation here. It's interesting to me that they can own their burning hearts after the revelation. I was feeling better.
Right.
I was feeling better. Yeah, you know. Come to think of it, it is. And indeed, if we want to take the wide view of the whole thing, which has happened here, God has validated His Son and the Messiah in the resurrection. Everything that Jesus has said and done is validated. He was right. Our God has not perished. He is the Messiah. All that He has said and done is right and appropriate, up to and including His sacrifice, and that struggle with that now. But authority, I guess, is come back into the, in the best sense of the word, author to create. The author of life is now back on the throne, and all is well.
And even in an Old Testament concept, our God won.
Our God won, and now the feast and celebration.
Yeah.
And then just foretaste of the feast to come. I remember a confirmation class where we're talking about foretaste, and what's a foretaste? And one of my kids, kind of like an hors d'oeuvre. I thought that was pretty good. We got a little story to share with you before we close up. Back in 1973, I was a student in New Haven, Connecticut, and it was January. And President Nixon had been elected, promising for a second time to end the Vietnam War. in been 4 years. And I went to a concert at the university, and at the end of that concert, someone got up on the stage and said, "Hey, we're all going down to Washington by bus tomorrow to protest on Nixon's inauguration day. And anybody who wants to, you know, go to the Village Green and you know, for $8, we'll take you down to Washington for the day." And so we ran home, my friend and I, and we put on our coats and we rode all night down to Washington and arrived there and gathered at the Lincoln Memorial with these thousands and thousands of protesters of every shape and size, and there were policemen on every, there were soldiers on every corner in Washington. So we had a march from the Lincoln. It was a raw day, like 35, 40 degrees, spitting like this, and we were outside, but we had thousands of people marched up to the Washington Monument, and I remember hearing speeches. But by the end of that day, 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, we were just dead and cold. And our buses were supposed to be parked on the other side of the park there. And so we ran into this liquor store and bought a bottle of wine that we were going to console ourselves with on the way home. And so we're walking through the park quite quickly, and out of this bush, like a size of a big lilac bush, we hear this voice, "Hey, looking around, are you hungry? And you want something to eat?" And we stopped and we peered, and underneath this bush next to this big tree is this guy sitting there with his knapsack. And we stopped and we kind of crawled into this bush out of the wind
with Moses.
Well, and we sit down, and this guy's sitting there, and he pulls out this big hunk of cheese and bread, and we pull this wine out of our knapsack and open it up. And then it was like, wham! You know, here we are, breaking the bread and the wine, and this guy turned out to be a seminary student, too, from Wisconsin or something. And at the end of this long, discouraging, cold day, here we are, breaking bread and under the tree. And there's times where I wonder if this was really a real person or not. I mean, this was an angel. It wasn't Moses. It was so weird in the sense that it was just like, you know, I mean,
and
I knew.
He was gone, right?
Then we were gone. I mean, it was just, but the thing is, we had the wine and he had the bread and the cheese and we got it together. And
That's great. And
it was just one of these moments of affirmation that our God reigns, that the kingdom of God does reign in the breaking of the bread.
Even in the inauguration of a president like Nixon.
That's right. Even then. I've always remembered that particular event in light of this story here.